From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in loud Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steven McGregor,
and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are psychic distance and audio middleware. It's hard to say, but if everyone's ready, let's start.
Whittlemare.
Just setting the tone up top.
I realize. I put the actual topics out of order. We're doing auto middle. Wow, it is hard. Audio middleware first.
All right, everybody, back to one.
Yeah.
We don't do two takes on this program.
No, we absolutely don't.
Before we get into it, I do want to say it's every now and again we get new patrons who sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
Yeah.
And yes, that's a stealth pitch. patreon.com/nicegamesclub. I'm sorry, but if you haven't signed up, please do.
Mm-hmm.
Any amount of money you send us,
we appreciate
it. We'll get you ad-free episodes, yes. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah. You've heard it from us before.
Yeah.
patreon.com/nicegamesclub. But I just wanted to say the thank you to those new folks. If that's you, really, really appreciate it. Our most recent patron comes to us from Canada.
Yeah.
They sent us $4 Canadian every month. I don't know how much that is in real money, but I'm sure it's, you know, like not
wow.
larger than nominal. Very much appreciated. But we've got a recent patron from Europe as well.
Yeah.
I think we get our download stats. We see the numbers pop up. We have people in South Africa. We have people in India and Korea, and that's super cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not a multilingual podcast, so that's like a tribute to the global dominance of the English language,
yeah.
If nothing else. I do think about that, but the nice thought is it's very cool that we have listeners all over the world,
yeah,
and appreciate that. But it somehow feels more real when we have listeners who like the show enough to actually give us a little bit of their Canadian money. And they're not don't just live down the street from us.
Yeah, it really helps a lot, and it makes us feel like it helps even solidify further that there are listeners who care about this program enough to see it keep going, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's great. Thank you.
It's
so much.
Really validating, cuz like I mean, we've talked about it on the show before, but like it's work.
Yes.
It's so much fun. But it is also a lot of work.
Yeah.
And I think we're in the point now where like we are good at it. But I think to keep us going, it is nice to have those reminders. And if you don't have the budget to subscribe to the show as a patron, I mean, we really think you should. patreon.com/nicegamesclub. But any little reminder sent our way would go a long way towards making us feel great about doing the show.
Yeah.
That's Discord. Send us feedback on the feedback forum.
Nicegamesclub.com/feedback. Yeah.
You know, just be part of the community. I think that really makes it feel absolutely worth it to us.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the largest expression of that support is definitely through Patreon. We really, really appreciate those people who do that. That helps pay for our guest booker, Max, who's been killing it this year.
Yes.
You know, and it also helps us keep the lights on in terms of like hosting and stuff like that. So we try to run a lean operation, but we're still a little in the red.
Yeah.
So every Canadian penny and pennies from elsewhere as well helps us along that way. So I did a whole ad here at the top of the show.
You really did.
But it came from my heart.
So it felt genuine to me.
Yeah.
As a person who benefits from that.
If you have thoughts on that, of course, nicegames.club/feedback.
Yeah.
Other news from me, we record here in the clubhouse, which is a room in this office space that I rent.
Yes.
Noble Robots, where I work and where a couple other people work, and we do events. And it's a space that, independent of Nice Games Club,
yeah,
it also a little bit in the red.
Yeah.
But it's a very valuable resource that that I maintain. Mm-hmm. And I just negotiated a new lease. So it's been 3 years.
Yeah.
Actually, when this episode comes out, it'll be 3 years since we moved in. To this space, and I can't imagine my professional life without it now, even though it is not a profit driver or anything as a co-working space that I run. It's still really beneficial to me to have the space, and it's where we record the show, and definitely valuable for the game dev community that we host events here and stuff. So it's important to us, but at the same time, I wasn't going to negotiate a lease that, you know, increased our rent and reduced our amenities. And so I kind of played some hardball I'm like talking myself up, but like I put in the effort to like negotiate a new lease.
Well, you also got a lot of stuff out of it, right?
Yes. So our rent went down a little bit, mm-hmm. and also we're going to get a couple of new improvements to the space that the management's going to pay for. So I'm really looking forward to that. It's going to make things just a couple little quality of life things.
Yeah.
But not much is going to really change. It is just going to be another three, and I put in an option for three more. Which means if the real estate market gets out of control in 3 years, I've locked in a rate now.
Nice.
And if it doesn't, then I can negotiate a better rate.
So that's great.
That's good for me. Mm-hmm. So that this has been real estate advice with Martha Croy. I've learned a little bit from doing this twice now. But I'm excited. And so I wanted to mention on the show because it's a big part of my professional life and it's a part of the life of the show as well.
Yeah,
because
that's awesome.
We do the show here.
I know that I think the Clubhouse in particular is going to get a few improvements, benefits from that, right? So
yes, we're going to try to get some Ethernet running through the space so we can wire some of the machines together. And that's all centered here in the Clubhouse.
Yeah.
Because that's where sort of our modem lives. And we're going to get it so that we can set up for playtest a little bit quicker.
Cool.
And also if somebody needs a faster upload, they can we'll have a little patch bay here to like that's the hope anyway. It's not a very big space, and honestly Wi-Fi for downloads, like I've been hooking up modems and building PCs forever, and I'm old enough to be like, Ethernet, always use Ethernet. Wi-Fi is bad, but I don't play games online, so I don't care about lag. And so it turns out if you don't care about lag, you just care about speed, Wi-Fi is great. Like, Wi-Fi is not slower than Ethernet and hasn't been for a while. And that was news to me when I moved in here. Because it's like, we can't plug in. I don't want to run cables all through around the size of the walls.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll just see how good the Wi-Fi is. And turns out, Wi-Fi is great. But when you want really a consistent upload speed or you want to network computers together, it's still very valuable. So it's one of the things. And it's nice especially when we do playtest, we have a bunch of the machines all hooked up together. So that we can stream all the machines in one go. It's a bit of a sophisticated setup. I'm quite proud of it. Mm-hmm. But that requires them all to be hardwired to each other. And that means that when we do playtest, we have cables on the ground.
Yeah.
And it's like, fine. It's not a problem.
Yeah.
But it'd be nice to
not have to deal with it.
Yeah. So this was a good time and good opportunity to be like, all right, if you want to keep us around, let's pay for some, upgrades.
Yeah.
And and they were like, yeah, sure. So
that's great.
It's good. It's a good amount of money too. So that's new with me. Ellen, is something new with you?
I was going to say that kind of upgrade has legs because if you decide not to stay here, the next person's also going to benefit from a faster.
Yeah. And that's why they agree to pay for these sorts of things.
That's why they agree to do it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But that's why you should bring it up, because they might say, that makes sense. Yeah.
But the thing is I'm such a small fry that like a lot of times what happens is that a tenant will pay for those improvements.
Yeah.
Because they really need it.
Yeah.
And then when they move out, they don't get to take it with them.
Right.
And I'm not, I couldn't bring myself to do that. So negotiate a good budget for, it can be worth it to people who do that in commercial real estate. But like, this isn't a business that makes money. This is a space I pay for to, supplant other activities. Mm-hmm. So I do have to be wise with the money.
Yeah.
As not fun as that can be sometimes.
Yeah.
It is way more fun to just spend money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, boy, is that true.
Part of me is like, if they actually just negotiate that amount off the lease. Mm. But like the incentives are not lined up for that to have been a good argument for them.
Ah, so. yeah.
I'll take the improvements. That'll be nice.
Mm-hmm. So you were asking about my update. It has nothing to do with negotiating leases or spending money. My employer sent me to a conference this couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Right after.
You Oh,
right.
You actually drove me down to the airport.
We got Ellen to the airport with like 5 minutes to spare or something. What was it? Because we had got stuck in road construction.
No, it was totally fine.
Okay,
we were at Terminal 2, and that's local speak for the not as busy terminal.
Yeah.
So it was very easy. I think it was like 10 minutes after you dropped me off. I was through security.
Oh, wow.
So it was really, it was really easy. But while we were there, while I was there, I was there with one other coworker, and one of the things we were doing was running some live games for the event. So I did some live Wheel of Fortune and multiple games of the game I designed Noodle. So they had like different games of noodle running every day, and they had like a best noodler contest that we got to give away a prize for. And then we did some live Wheel of Fortune using our platform on the luncheon, and it was pretty stressful. It went really well.
So were you like behind a lectern with a microphone? You're like Pat Sajaking the experience, or what does running it live mean?
The conference hosts had the MCs, so they were like interacting with the players and like reading the questions and so on and so forth. But I was controlling the actual experience. So the game that we have is a licensed Wheel of Fortune game. Yeah, licensed by Sony. And so it's got all the right aesthetics for the Wheel of Fortune, like the same logo and the music and everything. And so I was making sure that the cues were coming up and the transitions were coming up at the right time. And then I would input the letters. So players on the stage would like say, okay, I'm going to buy an A. I'm going to buy a vowel. And I'd click buy a vowel and they'd tell me which vowel and I click the vowel. Oh. So
you operated the machinery as they were on stage, sort of role playing.
That's fun. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, right. Because I guess somebody is. I always find it interesting when like Vanna White goes and hits the thing. Yeah. You know, sometimes it's timed a little differently because like they didn't hit the timing right or whatever. Like I don't know. You got to be the one doing the timing.
Well, Ellen was doing the thing that people think Vanna White did.
Yeah.
But really, it's you're the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone saw me.
Oh.
Right? Like, they called me like, "Hey, there's Ellen in the back table. She's going to run the game for us. We're going to host it up here." And so there were like 300 people in this luncheon, and a few people up on stage were, you know, they were called up from the audience to go play. And then, you know, so they would play. Definitely, this was a new build of the game that we haven't rolled out to production yet. Mm-hmm. So, like, we were testing some new things and definitely got some ideas about what we want to do differently, things that we should tweak. But yeah, it was cool to be able to do that and cool to have it work. And then after we did like two rounds of the game and then three puzzles for each game.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then at the end of each game, so you play three rounds and then you get the winner. The winner of the game got to spin an actual wheel, not just a digital wheel that I was spinning for them, but an actual wheel.
Yeah.
And then each section of that wheel aligned with a table or a couple tables in the luncheon, and those people got a prize, like a little, like a $10 gift card or something.
Cool. You know?
That's so fun. It was
super, super fun to see how like they folded that into the event and be part of that planning.
That's awesome. You got back okay? You got to your airport in time as well on the way back.
Yeah. No, it was great. So this was in Chicago, and it was the week before the DNC.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh.
There were signs for the Democratic National Convention everywhere, right? And, you know, I left on time for the airport, called my Lyft driver. Lyft driver came up there, and I was like checking email for most of the call or most of the ride, but it was like a 20, 25 minute ride.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put down my phone at one point. He was being very respectful, you know, like you do a lot of business, like driving and things like that. You probably learn to read people really well. And he was reading that I was busy doing something, but I put my phone down and I asked him like, "Oh, okay. Are you guys ready for the convention?" And he totally took that as a cue to like just chat. So the rest of the time we just talked about how, no, it's not going to change anything. Chicago's already nuts. If you add a bunch of other crazy stuff happening, you just get more Chicago. Basically, that was his take on having the DNC there. It's like, it's just another big event happening in Chicago.
Okay.
And then we talked about bread. So then I made it back to Duluth. I made it back to Minneapolis. Stayed overnight at my sister's. Took the bus the next day because the bus from the Twin Cities is really cheap. And it dropped me off at the bus stop at the UMG campus. But I missed the city bus that I was going to be able to take home by like 2 minutes. I saw it leaving. I'm like, So I like get out, I get my luggage, and I'm sitting there by the campus. I'm like, are there Lyfts? Is there Lyft or Uber in Duluth? Limited availability. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to walk home. Like it was just a mile walk when I have really sturdy luggage. So I just like dragging my luggage down the city.
I used to do that too, like every week when I would come back home from Duluth to Twin Cities.
Yeah.
Because I was working at Vetti Associates then, and I worked for him on the weekends because that was the only time I could do it.
Right.
Sure.
So I went back and forth. And yeah, I remember that trek.
And whenever I go to the airport, I take the train down there, and there's a stop very close to my apartment.
Yeah,
but it's still a couple of blocks from my apartment.
Yeah,
and just like taking my wheelie luggage a couple of blocks on a real city sidewalk, like that's torture. Like,
imagine if there were hills.
Yeah, I know. I just can't imagine. Like a mile, like that's wild.
Yeah,
I have this. That's why I always get like the REI luggage. So they have like these like really durable, like almost duffel bag style bags, but then they have like really rugged wheels on them. They're not like the omnidirectional wheels that you typically get with like airplane luggage, but they handle the Duluth sidewalks just fine, you know, which is actually pretty incredible because our sidewalks suck.
Really bad.
I didn't say anything, but yeah, when we were up there, they're really bad.
Yeah, they're not great.
At all. Streets and sidewalks are rough here. It was impressive. It didn't tip over once. It just rolled with me.
That's good.
Definitely better going down the hill though. I wouldn't want to take that up the hill.
Right.
All right. Well, we're all caught up, I think. I think we should probably get into the show.
Yeah, for sure.
I do want to waste our time with just one more thing, though.
Okay.
So, the DNC happened.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, from Minnesota, and there's like a whole bunch of buzz about Tim Walz.
Right.
So just, if you have any Minnesota questions, let us know.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of interest now. I'm seeing it on social media. I guess that's true. People are like, wait a minute, what's with Minnesota? Like, so there's a lot of interest saying we're there for you if you have questions. You know, like how many months of year are habitable?
Yeah.
Like how to get around in the Skyway.
Yes.
You know, the state fair is going on right now.
It is.
I don't think any of us.
The best.
Ellen likes the state fair.
I love the state fair.
I like the free stuff at the state fair.
Okay. And I hate the state fair.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway.
It's all you can drink milk.
So I hate the state fair. I think we've talked about the show before. Like when I was in college, I was a radio DJ, and I did a whole day at the state fair.
Oh,
I've never been back.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that actually sounds horrendous.
I was like, I worked a booth there.
Yeah,
that's enough. That's all I need for a lifetime.
Yeah, for sure. Man, jeez,
that's a little different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I was just putting this off a little bit because this is one of these topics that I do from time to time where I'm just going to talk the whole time and the two of you are going to just try to get in as wise. So fair warning to the listener, I'm going to talk about audio middleware.
Yeah.
So this is something that I'm picking a topic because it's what I'm working on right now. Like not as in like a thing that's going on like, you know, this month.
Background.
It's like, this is what I'm working on today.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So audio middleware, if you don't know what it is if you're working in a game engine or you know, not in a game engine even, you might want a piece of robust software to handle the audio for you in the game. And that's what the audio middleware is.
Yep.
The two big ones are WISE, W-W-I-S-E. I don't know why. Mm. I don't even know if you actually pronounce it that way or if it's WISE or W-WISE. I don't know. And I didn't look it up.
Okay.
The other one is FMOD.
Yeah.
Those are the two big ones. I'm actually not aware of any others that have anywhere close to that kind of market penetration.
Yeah.
But those are the two main ones. It's kind of like picking an engine. They would do a lot of the same things. And as I describe what they do, a lot of this is going to apply to both of them.
Yeah.
I have some experience with both of them, and I'll describe that as well. But the question is, well, wait a minute. I'm using a game engine. It has audio features. It has an audio API.
Right.
Why would I use this other thing that's just the same thing?
Yeah.
And essentially, it's filling a gap because the audio solutions in game engines are pretty bad.
Okay.
And you also may be familiar with WISE or FMOD because you've probably seen the logos in the title screens of many of your favorite video games.
Mm-hmm.
They are middleware that they work for game engines and they can like hook into them.
Yeah.
But they are themselves unique pieces of software that have integrations for multiple engines. And that includes proprietary engines that AAA studios use.
Okay.
And like things like Bink Video you may have seen or Scaleform for UI, like other things that you may, if you've played video games long enough, you're like, I know those names. I've seen that. Why do I know those names? Because those get their logos at the top of AAA games a lot.
Yeah.
They tended to be solutions that were designed for studios that were building their own engines.
Oh.
Because why bother doing a whole sound engine when you can just get something off the shelf to plug in?
Yeah, yeah.
The thing you're doing.
That totally makes sense now. That's why, I guess that's why FMOD and WISE are still like around, is because like they have those integrations in Unity, and a lot of the professionals use those things and are comfortable with them.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense.
And so you can imagine a world where there were more, there were fewer proprietary engines and the industry was a little bit more open with each other. There's still not, but if they were at, you know, the way we are now, sharing knowledge, if that existed 20 years ago, you might have, these tools might not be as powerful or as needed.
Yeah.
It might be just part of game engines, right? And then the competition between them would be between the engines.
Yeah.
But both of these solutions work for Unity and Unreal. They also have community-managed integrations that work with Godot.
Okay.
They're not quite as robust, but the thing about these is that they're designed to be hooked into anything. That's the, what they're designed for. So, WISE and FMOD both maintain the integrations with Unity and Unreal themselves, and then they offer them to you from them. So it's real plug and play.
Yeah.
Other integrations are available from other sources. And so that's why you can use it in Godot. You can use it in Game Maker.
Yeah.
And you may find that one is better than the other, depending on your engine of choice. But if you're using the two big ones, then either of them are available to you.
Sure.
What I would recommend is probably if you're indie, if you're a team smaller than 10, if you're not hiring an audio person, if you're doing it yourself, I think FMOD is probably a little bit easier to use.
Okay.
It is. It's simpler. It's easier to wrap your mind around, especially if you don't have audio experience in other fields.
Yeah.
But I would say the application that you use is a little clunkier. It's not as elegant.
Okay.
But WISE is it's a much better piece of software in terms of how its UX, how it's presented, but it's also more complicated. It's the metaphors are more complicated. There's more to it, and you're unlikely to need all of that.
Yeah.
But they still both have very similar capabilities. So, and I don't have enough experience in either to really compare them in terms of what their potentials.
Yeah. So I don't have a lot of experience working in audio middleware, but we had to try to integrate some of that into Unity for that horror game that we were working on.
Mm-hmm.
And the audio engineer we hired to work on it was basically like, I feel more comfortable. I think he said I was more comfortable in FMOD, but for the most part, it doesn't actually matter.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's the same experience you've had as well.
And pretty often, and so there's two points you raised which are interesting. One is a lot of times you'll hire an audio person who is sometimes will come from they'll just be an audio engineer who started doing game music or game audio.
Yeah.
Other times they will come up in games and that will be their specialty.
Yeah.
They will often have a preference. So if you have a small team and your audio person is like, I like this tool, then that's the tool your game is using.
Right? Yeah.
Like they'll have a lot of say because they sort of own that part of the project.
Yeah.
And I think we've talked about this when we've interviewed music folks on the show, but like more than any other component in video games, audio still tends to be its little island.
It's true.
We've talked about why in previous episodes. Maybe we can link those in the show notes. But so that's one element is that, and that's kind of what's nice about these tools being sort of agnostic, is that you can have someone who doesn't have a lot of programming experience, doesn't have a lot of experience with an engine. Like they may not know anything about Unity or Unreal, but they're really good in these tools.
Yeah.
And you can hire them to work in your game.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
And so now the question, of course, is why would you use these tools instead of just the integrated solutions, because they,
right,
you know, and I teased it that like they're not great, and that's true, but it's I would say it's good enough for most games if you just want to use the integrated audio. There's no reason you should jump at this,
okay,
because there are costs.
Yeah.
But if you have more complicated audio systems, if you have sound effects that you don't want to, that you want to create alternate versions of without having to ship multiple files, you know, let's say you have different jump sounds. Well, you can make 7 different jump sounds and make some code in your game to randomize which one plays.
Yeah.
Or you could have 1 or 2 jump sounds and use this middleware tool to actually modify it at runtime to change the pitch, to change the, you know, to,
sure, yeah,
you know, or you can have one piece of audio that has all of them in it, and so you can compress that file better, and then your audio middleware can actually create separate different events that start at different points, which you could do in Unity, for example, but it would be more complicated to set up.
Yeah, yeah.
In something like Fmod, you can do this a little bit more within the application.
Have you felt that Fmod is more open, less black box than Unity is?
Than Unity?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're driving at, except to say that when you license these things, you can get source code access if you need it.
Okay.
But I would say for a lot of indies, that's not going to be something you would want.
Oh, okay. I'm just wondering how flexible it is versus Unity. Because sometimes when you're working within Unity, and, well, probably less so in Unreal, but still, you'll get, like, stuck trying to solve a problem that, like, you could solve if you could just see the code and change some things, but you can't do that.
Ah, I see. I would say it's more black boxed.
Oh, okay.
And that's a benefit, I would say.
Oh, all right.
Because it's meant to be a utility.
Yeah.
It's not meant, it has an API, and every integration is essentially a Unity plugin or Unreal plugin that gives you an API in your own code that you access. And that's, you know, great. And that you can get some visibility into. But the actual under the hood of it all, where what's it wired to, is kind of black box. It's just very capable. And the idea is that you are meant to be a user of this. You're not meant to be you're not meant to create your version of it or use it to build something.
That makes sense.
And the application you use, the Fmod Studio or the Wyze Studio, I don't know if it's called Wyze Studio, but the Wyze application, they're sort of like digital audio workstations. They're a little bit like Pro Tools or Audition that we use to record the podcast. It's that kind of, it's a separate piece of software that you open up and you edit in there. That's one of the reasons. Yeah, again, that's one of the reasons why you can hire somebody who has expertise in that piece of software. They never need to open your Unity project.
Right.
They have their own project that then compiles the information that's needed that you put in your game, and then your game has the APIs to interact with those assets and stuff like that.
Okay.
Again, with what you would need for, why you would do this, the example you give is like the horror game you were
working. Yeah, yeah.
And one of the reasons why that's probably a good, I'm not sure this is exactly why your team chose to use a tool like this for this, but you have a lot more control over the audio.
Yeah.
And you have a control in a way that is part of this application. It's like using Photoshop. Mm-hmm. It's not quite, you're not doing it in code. You're not modifying pitch and layering and adding reverb, and you can do that in code. The API is available to you to do that.
Yeah.
But you can also just create it in the studio
environment.
Okay. And so that helps you with your project because you're going to be shipping less data. So you're not doing 10 audio files for each the 10 different use cases. Mm-hmm. You're just shipping one audio file, and then in the game, you can modify it for the 10 different use cases.
Yeah.
That's not going to solve all your problems. Sometimes you might need to do a new piece of audio if it's different enough. But it's a full audio workstation in that sense. You can put effects. You can mix a bunch of things. So if you have a bunch of sound effects and you want to combine them into another sound effect, you would do that, you know, somehow. And then you'd get that extra file and put it in your game and play that one instead.
Yeah.
But in a software like this, you can create you can create it as a timeline. And then that becomes its own event that you can then play as if it were a separate piece of audio.
Okay.
And then those channels can be toggled. And so you can, with the API. So there's just, it's tons more flexibility.
Yeah.
In a sense that there's no reason a game engine itself couldn't also provide all of these tools. Just none of them do.
Right.
Because there's a lot to it.
There's a lot, yeah.
And it comes from a different tradition of technical expertise, frankly.
Right.
One of the things that is interesting for me personally is I used Unity's built-in audio system for Widget Satchel.
Yeah, okay.
And I learned it for that game, and I was kind of impressed by it. I'm like, oh, this is really interesting, the audio mixer. And I think the audio tools were relatively new to Unity at the time, that version of the audio tools.
Yeah.
And I was pretty happy with it. But we had some dynamic music in the game.
Yes.
That would change depending on the player character, and then it would also change for the levels. And at a certain point, the audio system wasn't syncing things well enough that I just baked in all the combinations and just did that. It was kind of underwhelming. I was like, oh, we have this cool system, but whatever, I'll just do it, you know, at edit time and ship a couple more files. No big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so Audio Middleware would have done a lot better with syncing those files together.
Sure.
It would have just been it's a better system for that. But the other part of it is that when I started using Fmod for Dream Settler, which is what I'm doing now, I was reminded, it's not like something a thing I forgot, but I did need reminding,
Yeah.
Oh, right. this is much better way to handle audio because I have experience in audio mixing and engineering.
Right. Yeah.
So your mileage may vary. That may not be true for you. But I think one of the reasons why indie developers probably have a harder time getting excited about it is because it is a whole different discipline. It's a new piece of software you need to learn, and it works. I'm a big proponent of doing things in code where possible.
Yeah.
I don't love handling things in the Unity inspector if I can avoid it. You most of the time can't avoid it, and so you have to get good at that as well.
Yeah.
But I always like when I can have a solution that's just in code because it's cleaner, it's simpler, I can get my head around it a little bit better.
Sure.
But at the same time, I had years and years of experience working with these kinds of big studio type applications.
Right, right.
And I'm very comfortable with that.
Yeah.
And I was kind of excited to be working in one again.
Yeah.
For a bigger game project and realizing like, oh, you know what? I probably could have made much better use of it on Widget Satchel, even though Widget Satchel didn't need it.
Yeah.
And so your mileage will definitely vary based on how excited you are to like learn a whole new thing.
Yeah.
But the key to it is that regardless of which of these middleware solutions you use, it is extremely complicated to set up.
Okay.
And learn.
Yes.
And then once you get it all wired up, it is very easy to use. And I think that's the cost benefit analysis you have to run.
Okay.
And that's true for a lot of like big, you know, plugin style things. Like Rewired's another example.
Yeah, that's true.
Where it's like Rewired is for input in Unity. And you and I love it.
Oh,
it's very popular.
Yeah.
People don't like the way that Unity handles it. Unity did a whole new input system, very much inspired by Rewired, works very similarly. Mm. People are still using Rewired.
Yeah.
Because Rewired is great.
Uh-huh.
But it's very...
It takes a lot to set it up.
It's very laborious to set up.
Yeah.
But once it's set up, oh boy, things are just so easy.
It's so clean, yeah.
And the things you can do with it. So it's very similar to that. And now that's a Unity plugin. So again, it's the middleware being the way that it is, being essentially an engine bolted onto an engine. Mm. Because in the end, we're all just shipping C++ applications. Like how it got there is like... whatever.
It's really interesting. I appreciate that you brought it up that like it's difficult to implement these things.
Yeah.
Initially, because we actually didn't end up using
FMod
stuff because we couldn't figure out how to get it to work. Yeah. And I have no experience with that. So we didn't have time at the time to figure it out. So we just opted to just do what we could in Unity.
Yeah.
And that worked out okay. But I think I definitely can see the benefit. In having FMod tools like that, especially if we have somebody who's experienced with those tools to use them in ways that would benefit the game, where we weren't able to get to that point, but like it would have really helped, and I think it would have like made things a little bit, it would have sped up some of the work that we had to do because thankfully the audio engineer we hired was willing to like do a little bit of code. Mm-hmm. It's mostly just copy pasting stuff I did, which is totally all I was going to end up doing anyways. So like. It works.
Yeah.
But I'm just glad somebody, because like, I think if you're hesitant to do code, you're really hesitant to like even look at scripting. So like just having somebody able to do that was really helpful. But like if we had FMod, we could have made some of those manipulations without having to do adding all of those lines of code and things. It would have been helpful. That's good to hear. Yeah.
The reason that, you know, indie developers either individuals, small teams, small companies like yours, can even make this decision now is because licensing is much more indie friendly than it used to be.
Yes.
And I'll detail that. I think at the end of this topic.
But okay.
I think the last reason that you might want to choose this, is because they all are really good, or both of these examples are really good at targeting different platforms. So if you're shipping on multiple consoles. Mm-hmm. All this is built in, and a lot of times what they do is they will compile the audio assets for each platform in a way that is optimal for that platform, which you can adjust as you like. So mobile, we need something that is a little bit more compressed, and we're going to uncompress it at runtime. We're going to have a lower bit rate because we, you know, blah 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 blah. And then you can do that in a game engine as well.
Yeah,
but it's a little bit more finicky. Whereas these tools are designed specifically to do this, so they're just a settings menu. This platform, these are the settings you need for this.
Cool.
Ready to go.
Yeah.
In Unity, for example, you can do that. Mm. You can set defaults, and you can do it on a per-asset basis. All that is true in these middleware as well, so it's not like it's impossible.
Yeah.
It's just designed for that in a way that Unity is designed more for more of a generic thing for all asset types.
Yeah.
Which is good. That generic approach is very helpful because you can learn one way to do it and you understand how images, video, audio, all that works. But sometimes with the audio, you want to be a little bit more specific, and this allows you to do that. So that's one of the big advantages. So the last thing, but it is very telling because that's not something a lot of indies are going to need.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing when you decide whether you want to do it, I think you want to commit yourself to learning and getting excited about doing it.
Yeah.
And that it also opens up the possibility space. Now right. that you've set it up, now you can play with it a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you don't think that's going to be you, then I would say that you can still go for it, but you recognize that you're going to be doing a lot of learning and you may not get a lot of actual material benefit
yeah.
on a smaller project.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I mean, some of the artistic, well, I actually thinking of it from a business standpoint, so maybe this isn't the great uh-huh. example, but I know that players really appreciate adaptive like audio things,
yeah.
like if the music or sounds change based off of the context of the game.
Right.
And I think in video games in particular, that is very valuable
yeah.
to have because it changes the impacts of certain sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And audio, so it's definitely worthwhile looking into.
Yep. So I'm gonna outline some of the sort of the metaphors that both of these tools use, just to sort of get an idea for like how it sort of expects you to use it. So one of the main things is sound banks. So this is essentially compiled files that consist of one or multiple pieces of audio.
Yeah.
You can get all the audio in your game and compile it down to a single sound bank file.
Okay.
And again, this helps for compression. For delivery, for updates, for, you know, it's just kind of like an asset bundle, if you're familiar, or addressables, if you can
remember yeah.
that in Unity.
Okay.
Very similar kind of idea. It's also, again, a way to, you know, make good use of space. And so that in the software, you can assign different audio clips to different sound banks for, you know, what you need. You might find that you only need to ship certain banks for certain versions of the game.
Mm.
And so you can separate those out. You can have, you know, DLC can be separated out.
Oh, cool.
So it can be delivered separately. You can have common files as part of the base thing, or you can have it in multiple banks. If you want to, you know, if you want to like load things up without loading like a larger organize it however you want.
Yeah.
But file management is one of the things it does. That's sort of separate from like it being an audio mixer, which is kind of what you think it sort of is. It's an audio mixer, but for games.
Yeah.
And yes, it is. And that's another one of the things about it, which is mixers and channels. So this is one of those things that like Unity has that sort of basic audio mixer that I did like when I used it,
mm-hmm.
but it's only because I was comparing it to nothing and forgetting like how good you could have it. And so the thing about these things, it's like a full audio mixer. If you're familiar with using those types of tools, this will be very familiar to you. It's all the same language, but because it's for games, you can break things down. You can definitely do sub mixes, or called buses,
okay.
which we do here on the podcast.
Right.
When we do our audio templates.
That's what those are.
And but also because it's for games, each individual file also has its own kind of like integrated sub channel, so that because your game may need to change the volume of a file, not of a channel, but it's much easier to work in a mixer. So you want to have like audio settings where you change the music.
Yeah.
So in your game engine, you might say like, all right, when I determine the volume of this file, I'm going to say file, you know, this audio class that I wrote for this audio file, I'm going to give it a volume property and I'm going to change the volume of that, but I need to multiply it by the channel that I've set up in the settings menu.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It's not crazy. That's normal. But when you use one of these middleware tools, that's kind of all ready to go for you.
Yeah. Okay.
So you assign things to different channels and you do it in the studio. So the file, when you load it into your game engine, understands what channel it's part of, where it's sorted. You don't need to do that in the game engine.
Huh.
And then, but each file has its own little secret channel in it that
you can
change the pan property or the volume or add reverb to it, like as, you know, different. Sends or returns if you're thinking about audio mixer language.
Yeah.
And so it's much more complicated than a normal audio mixer because it understands that it's dynamic. So it's a little best of both worlds in that sense.
Okay.
It's pretty easy to set up if you just want to put all the music on one channel, but all the sound effects on another. Boom, Bob's your uncle, you're done.
Yeah.
You wire it up in your settings menu, you're ready to go. But then you also have that full flexibility that you would expect from being able to control individual sound sources.
Okay.
And so you can do, that's channels and mixers. But then, of course, on top of that, you can do effects, triggers, dynamics. You can say in your game, you can have a trigger when you enter a certain area that modifies the music. So it, and you can set up all of those things, and the API in the plugin helps you connect those two things. But then you can say, all right, now change the mix to like widen the stereo field when we enter the cave.
Yeah.
So things feel a little bit more echoey or whatever.
Yeah.
Like add some reverb, add some echo.
Okay.
And take the left and right channels and spread them out. You can set that all up in the studio application and then just hit a trigger. And then you can have a volume that when you enter the volume, you can just run that line of code. And
cool.
So it's just a lot simpler to do more with it.
Yeah.
And because these are all, a lot of these are known use cases.
Yeah.
There's way less reinventing the wheel.
Right.
Because you kind of like a million games have done what you probably want to do.
Yeah.
So it is because it's purpose built for this purpose. And Unity developers in particular understand that Unity is so flexible that it like frequently just falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes it's nice just to have one way to do things.
Yeah.
And so that's what these tools sort of help with. You're not looking for example code on Stack Overflow because someone did it before. You're actually looking for how do you do this in this program? And there are specific instructions because that's what it was built to do.
Yeah.
Because it has a smaller mandate than a game engine does.
That's great. Yeah. I'm like actually really interested in like looking into this. But how much would this set me back?
Well, that's we've reached that point of the topic of licensing, because that's the last thing I want to talk about, which is it used to be very expensive.
Mm.
And if you make a lot of money on your game, if you're an Ubisoft, it's still going to cost you a lot.
Okay.
But both of these middleware tools are very affordable for indies in that they're both free.
Ayo.
There's two things about it. One is the cost, and the other thing is the logo. I'll talk about both.
Okay.
So the logo first. They both require the use of a logo and it has to happen before the title screen, before the start screen,
sure.
Which you've seen in a lot of games.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit unusual. Like not a lot of middleware tools do that, but it's just standard for these now.
Yeah.
That's the terms of service for those.
Okay.
So you really can't get around that. You can pay a lot of money in the case of, I think Fmod lets you pay a lot of money to get around it.
Mm.
But like, why would you
do that? Yeah.
Yeah. It's just to get rid of the logo. You give them like, I think $6,000 or something.
Yeah. That's too much.
And at the indie level, I think you can't do that. It's only when you have a higher license.
Oh, really?
Huh. So I'll get into those. So for Wise, this is actually newer for them. They only recently got into it.
Okay.
And I worked with it on a different project, and it was very frustrating for me. It's one of the reasons why I recommend Fmod is because Wise still lives in a world of like, it lives in kind of a PlayStation 2 world.
Okay.
Where it expects you to have like an employee that deals with this.
Sure.
And so like I had to actually email back and forth with one of their representatives to like get like it all figured out.
Oh, annoying.
And I'm like, this is a waste of your time because I'm on the indie license. I'm not paying you anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was very frustrating for both of us. Anyway, so they're sort of trapped in that world where you have to register your project with them,
mm-hmm.
which means if you work with consoles, you need to prove to them you are a licensed console developer, and then you get their plugin for that. And that's not uncommon for a lot of middleware, but for them, it was a little bit more involved than it probably should be. They just had not updated their customer relations system to work with this new indie license of theirs. But it is a very good license.
Yeah.
It's free for projects that have budgets below $250,000. What that means is you can have if you spend less than $250,000 on your game and it makes $1 billion, doesn't change that.
Okay.
It's by the budget.
Yeah.
So that's what
that is nice.
Both of these services are very friendly when it comes to that in terms of how they actually make their money. If you have a budget that's below $2 million but above $250,000, then it costs you $7,000 to license it for the first platform, so PC or whatever.
Okay.
And then for each additional platform it's $3,500.
Okay.
If you have a $2 million budget, that is easy. It's not per seat.
It's per project.
So it's very affordable, even at that level.
Yeah.
Above that, it gets more expensive, but I don't think we're talking to a lot of people who have budgets, who are responsible for budgets over $2 million.
Yeah.
Some of you may be working on games that have budgets that high, but I don't think a lot of you are making purchasing decisions. Wise also offers a royalty-based license, so you can just pay out 1% instead of anything else. That do the math on your own. That's not going to be very useful even for, I think, the pro license is still not going to be that useful, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
They also do like monthly license fees for games as a service games.
Okay.
And those start free for a certain amount of revenue per month. So if you're like an indie making a games as a service game.
What are you doing?
I mean, that's question one.
Yeah, but
if that is you, and if you're a new company taking a risk,
that's fair.
You pay nothing, and then in months where you don't get over a certain amount of money, mm-hmm. you pay nothing, and then you only pay if your game becomes successful.
Yeah,
and so that's a pretty interesting. And even if your budget is high, they have different options.
Okay,
for most people, the indie license is going to be good. If you have a really high budget production, then the pro license is very affordable.
Yeah.
FMod is very similar, just the numbers are different. Their indie license is free for projects with budgets below $600,000. So it's very permissive, but they have a revenue limit. So
okay.
if your revenue is below $200,000 a year, then it's still free. So if you are an indie hit and you make a little bit more than that, or you get a really sweet Game Pass deal, you might be subject to that.
Okay.
But it's only $2,000 if the revenue bumps up.
Oh.
If your budget is still below $600,000,
yeah.
and you make more than that, $2,000, it's yours.
Okay.
And that's per game.
Okay.
So if you ship on 5 platforms, still $2,000.
Wow.
So very, very affordable.
Yeah.
It just has that threshold.
Yeah.
If your budget is below $1.8 million, and I don't know how they came up with that number.
Mm.
Then it's $6,000 per game, and there's no revenue limit on that one.
Okay.
So FMod asks for less than Wise. Just has that one extra thing.
Yeah.
But both I think are very affordable, considering that they're dependent on your budget and your revenue.
Yeah.
And so the scale is very friendly.
Like, yeah.
If you're not sure you're going to make any money, then you do not have to worry about paying them anything.
Right. That's
which is
cool.
Which is quite nice. It makes it very easy. That's why things have changed.
Yeah.
Because now it's a very powerful tool. And now it's just easy to try it.
Yeah.
Where it didn't necessarily used to be.
That's really cool because, I think that you can also, potentially experiment with some of these things in, a game jam or something.
Yeah.
You're not going to make any money off of that.
Yeah.
That's really neat.
Yeah. And I might have missed to say, but for FMod, if it's over 1.8, it's 6,000 is what it was. Mm. So, yeah, still pretty cheap.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's it. So, that's the whole thing. It's definitely worth trying out.
Yeah.
I would say it's not something you could probably wrap your mind around for a game jam game.
Sure. Okay. That's
fair. A lot of times I like to recommend new tools in a game jam setting because it's low stakes.
Yeah.
But the thing about these tools is you're not going to realize their benefit
until you've messed with it for longer than a week or something.
So that's kind of the last question is do you start off from jump thinking you're going to need it and then get it all wired up? And if you don't need it that powerful, well, you set it up, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you say, well, we'll see. We'll try it as we go. For Dream Settler, we decided early because the game is going to have a lot of music in it.
Yeah.
And it's a fake operating system, so we know we're going to have lots of dynamic, if not dynamic mixing or effects, we are going to have that. But even if it weren't for that, we're going to have lots of dynamic playing. We need to know how many sounds are playing at once. We need to make sure that because the player can overwhelm our system because we give them a lot of ability to do things.
Right.
So we want to make sure that anything that would cause slowdowns that we are... And so the more sophisticated our audio solution is, the better we're able to handle that, even if we didn't use a lot of its other features.
That totally makes
sense. I think we're going to.
Mm.
But for you, it might be a case of we'll just use the simple system, and then when things get complicated, we'll tear it down and throw in one of these middleware.
Mm-hmm.
That's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to refactor, so I don't mind rewriting a thing.
Yeah.
If that's you as well, that could be an option. Just don't use it till you need it. But you might not realize how soon you need it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you just get it from jump, then it's a lot of work to set up, and then you may find you just don't use any of the benefits and it was a waste of your time.
Yeah.
So always risks. And that's true for any kind of tool you choose.
Yeah.
You don't know what it's going to, if you're not familiar with it yet. And again, it's hard to learn and use these tools unless you actually need them.
Yeah.
So I would recommend if you're thinking about them to find somebody in your community or online who has experience, who you can chat with or who you can work with on a project who can help you learn it and understand its benefits.
Yeah.
If you can't, then I think, figure it out for yourself. I wouldn't be that scared. I mean,
yeah, okay.
That's what I'm doing.
That's what I've learned from this topic, really, is that it's a bit daunting maybe to set it up, but once you get past that point, then you can just kind of experiment and stuff. So it seems like it's worthwhile.
Yeah, pretty much.
We don't have an audio person at Future Club, but if we had somebody who was curious about it, I mean, honestly, I'm a little curious about it, but I don't want to do more tech things for Future Club, not gonna lie. But if we had somebody else who was curious about it, we could maybe get them set up and then they could try experimenting with things. Cause I think sound is kind of, like you said, sound is kind of siloed off. And I know at Future Club, we kind of think of it at the last moment.
Yeah. So. Well, also at Future Club, you have a couple of projects on the hopper right now and a lot of them are different engines.
Yes.
And so having, if you pick a sound pattern and you hire a sound person, then that actually is a organizational benefit to be set up that way. It lets you be flexible with engines.
Yeah.
You may not want that going forward.
Yeah.
You're the one writing it all those
yeah, things. Yeah.
But, yeah, lots of reasons to choose it, lots of reasons not to. Hopefully this gave you some background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you. Okay, so we've talked about this. Mark brought this up at the top of the show that we've gotten a few patrons, and we very much appreciate it. It's helpful financially if you can support us, but if you cannot, if it doesn't fit within your budget or something like that, there's other ways to support us. One way you could do that is you could send Nice Games Club to a friend. You know, we have so many episodes. We actually have as many episodes as there are days of the year.
As of this episode.
Yes. Yeah. if there's a friend of yours who's interested in video game development at all, in any way, any capacity, as a hobbyist, professionally, what have you, I'd like to think that our show is a very valuable resource. Not just if you like listening to podcasts, but also our website just has like a lot of cool stuff on it. If you would like to support us through other means aside from Patreon, you can send the podcast to a friend of yours.
Yeah.
You can send them nicegames.club. You can send it to somebody on their favorite podcast app. If you send them their website, they'll get a list of they can find all of our resources and things on there. There's a lot of value from that, and it could be like a little nice gift. A little surprise for somebody.
It helps us, but yeah. Really, it's a gift you're giving to a friend of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the pitch. You could be like, hey, would you like to listen to game dev information every day?
Yeah.
Because I have a podcast for you with a huge back catalog.
Yes. Yeah. So
you come up with, something with your own pitch.
Yeah, yeah. You know your friends better than we do, so. Yeah. However you can support, either financially, potentially through Patreon, or word of mouth, through our sending our podcast how you can. We appreciate it.
You can rent a plane and with a banner.
Yeah.
Be creative.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Find a way to get your nice hosts into your friends' ears.
Yes. All right. My topic.
Yeah.
This is going to be kind of interesting because, I don't actually know a lot about this topic, but we're going to talk about it as a group. My friend recently introduced me to the idea of psychic distance, which, how I understand it, my friend is a writer.
Yeah.
He's also working on games recently.
This isn't like a stat on an X-Men trading card?
No. It's not.
All right, fine.
I can see how that would be a thing. Like, how far you can... psychic things? How do you psychic? Anyway, no, I'm all distracted.
I like how seriously you took this gag.
I do that all the time. It's hard how my mind works. He's been working in games recently, and we were just like having a conversation about this, and he brought up this idea of psychic distance. Effectively, from how I understand how psychic distance works, is how close you feel to, as a viewer, as an outsider, like a player, a viewer, a reader, something, to a subject in this medium. So, like, for instance, there's a few sentences that I typed up that, like, I based off of, like, this article that we'll link in our show notes. Example of, like, a very far psychic distance is somebody a statement that's, like, the person walked out of their home and into the snow. Mm-hmm. You just... as a matter of fact, there's this person walking out in the snow, and there's snow, I guess. That's the effect. Another example is Steven trudged into the snow-covered yard, prepped for his journey. You kind of have an understanding that that the subject is, I guess, me in this instance.
A little closer.
Yeah, I'm a little closer. I'm like prepped for something. You kind of understand a little bit more about who this person is. Mm-hmm. And not just that, but like you also can kind of, you can see that this person is the subject, right?
Yeah.
And then another example is, ugh, I hate the snow. Why do I still live here? I think about that sometimes.
Remember, send us your Minnesota questions.
Yes, yes, please do. this is an example of like pulling it in very close. Now you're like, you're getting it from a first person perspective.
Yeah.
You're getting me in this instance, my actual thoughts about me walking into the snow and having to do this. And things like that.
So this term comes from the world of books.
Yes, it does. And I think that like it's kind of more of a recent term. It's not like this isn't like hundreds of years, as far as I understand it. It's not like a 100-year-old conversation that people have been having, but it's like more of a recent thing that, like, I think that people in the writing field have want to have more understanding on. Daniel, my friend, brought this up from the perspective of games, which I think is really fascinating, because it's definitely not something I had even come across at all until he brought this up to me. But it's totally useful for video games.
Yeah.
In a way that I think that I certainly haven't even, I've never even conceived of, but it's definitely affected how I consume games.
Yeah. Well, in books, you could say, oh, well, two of these are third person and one of them is first person.
Right.
But it sounds like describing it in a different way lets you decouple it from its form.
Yeah.
So you could have a first person that is has some psychic distance. You get a third person. It's not, you know, that's a good way to get to establish distance.
Yeah.
But not definitive. It might be why it's just it's a more nuanced term. Sounds in games, it's like an immersion metric.
Potentially.
In a way that can help us decouple a lot of what we think about as immersion, including first person, third person perspective.
Yeah.
You know, including things like, oh, immersion involves visuals and sound.
Yeah.
And even narrative, and think about, oh, well, if we think about it in terms of psychic distance, then we can think about all the tools that games have,
right,
that can establish that without having to, I mean, it sounds like that's what, why it would be beneficial to think in this term.
Yeah, well, I think it's a narrative device as well, right?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I think that's kind of a lot of my thinking on it is, like, how do you bring this in video games from a narrative perspective? And I like to think that the games that I work on in the future and now, you know, mechanics, narrative, the immersion as a result come from that combination of things.
Yeah.
And so that's part of why I'm thinking of it from that perspective. But, like, I think you bring up a good point in that, like, just because the description or the game takes place from a first person perspective versus a third person perspective, that does not necessarily mean that the psychic distance that you're experiencing is more or is further or closer because of that.
Yeah.
You can have a first person game that feels very disconnected from you as a person, as an individual, just due to how you treat the character in the game. So, like, for instance, Portal 2, right? You play as an individual, her name is Shell, and she's going through all these puzzles and things like that. And I suppose GLaDOS is always, you know, talking about you and how you're bad at solving these puzzles and whatever else. But it's not always directed at the player, it's directed at Shell some of the times. And so, like, GLaDOS will refer to things that Shell has experienced but you have not experienced. And that will pull the player away from the character as a result of that.
I would actually argue it's the opposite.
Okay.
And I think it's one of the reasons why this term is useful, because the thing about that is that, I mean, for a Valve silent protagonist.
Yes.
Shell has a lot of personality because GLaDOS imposes that.
Yeah,
but does it by talking to you.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a case where, like, technically the story is such that you are not embodying the character.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, there are lots of games where your character has a name, but you're expected to play it as if it's you.
Yeah.
And Portal is one that's not the case.
Right.
Portal is one where it gives the character a very light backstory, but it's not you.
Yeah.
And so you would say that has a lot of distance, but because GLaDOS is constantly in your ear,
yeah,
I would say that puts you closer into the, in a way that's different from how we normally describe it.
Okay.
So,
I mean, guess what you're saying.
I guess I'm disagreeing with you, but in service of, like,
no,
what's beneficial about this as a lens.
Yeah. I mean, I brought this up because I don't know what the heck I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
So you correcting me is helping.
Well, I mean, that's just my impression of it.
No, that's fair.
I don't know if you could, I mean, you could get five different people who have different understandings of what that means.
Yeah, that's true. It's not like I have the literal academic understanding of it or anything like that.
I just like that it takes it away from, like, the mechanical.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think that can be an aspect of it as well, right?
Mm-hmm. It's what you'd use to get there, but it's
right,
not tied one-to-one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I suppose, arguably, you know, in Portal, you have as much agency in the game as Chell does. So, like, I guess that brings that closer as a result, maybe? I don't know. Now I'm thinking. Now I'm correcting myself. Thanks, Mark. No.
Well, maybe it can help to think about games you've worked on.
Yeah. Okay.
Because you're more familiar with the motivations behind a lot of those things.
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's bring up Widget Satchel because we all worked on that.
Yeah.
I think that like the in terms of like the actual narrative, it's all third person from Sprocket, right? We're oftentimes all of the actual conversations. Sprocket doesn't talk. All the actual conversations and thoughts and stuff come from the crew members that are being affected due to the result of Sprocket's actions.
Right. You play as Sprocket. You yes. knock stuff over. Yes. You cause trouble as you go through the station.
Yes.
And none of the other characters ever interact with you.
Right.
But they are responding to the things you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so I suppose... So what does that do? How does that make a player feel in terms of connected to Sprocket? I suppose the crew mates are all responding to the actions that Sprocket is taking, and by proxy, you are taking.
Yeah.
So
this might break down the definition a little bit because I can think of two ways to describe it. So I would say, as the person who did the most narrative work on that game, my intention was to make it very third person.
Yes.
You control Sprocket, but you are not Sprocket.
Right, yeah.
Right? And I really wanted... And there's a couple of things I did to make that happen. So when you encounter... That's one of the reasons why all the other characters in the cutscenes who describe what's going on, mm-hmm. they not only do not interact with Sprocket, they do not... can make the connection that Sprocket is involved.
Yeah.
And...
Okay, yeah.
And so I didn't want... those characters who are like, oh, there's been a fire on level 2. Wonder what's going on down there. It's probably because this other person, you know, and of course, the dramatic irony of that is interesting.
Yeah.
But also, I didn't want them to ever address the player.
Yeah.
To sort of establish that distance.
Right.
Not having a term for it then.
Yeah.
But, and at the same time, all of the, whenever you as the character come to like a little piece of lore, the little terminals throughout the station.
Yeah.
Or when you go into the menu and you see... the descriptions of the things you collect, mm-hmm. there's two parts to that. One is when you look at the terminals, those are all written as like encyclopedia entries. They're not you reacting to it. And that's not uncommon, right?
Yeah.
So there's nothing special or innovative there. But that was designed in a way to make the Sprocket separate from the life of the station.
Yeah.
This is not an environment built for Sprocket.
Yeah.
On the other hand, when you go into the pause menu and you look at the socks you collect or the trinkets, all of them are from third person, or they're written third person, but they're written to Sprocket.
Yeah.
So like there's the tube of toothpaste.
Yeah.
Which is described as a tube of goo that tastes bad. We'll try again later.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite first person. It's kind of second person.
Yeah.
In a sense, it's Sprocket's thoughts, but it's so that is a separate layer. It's in the pause menu.
Yeah.
But it's not in the world of the game.
Yeah.
So there's some nuance there.
Yeah.
But I think that I definitely wanted there to be some distance for that. So that's a long explanation for that part of it. The other side of it is, and Ellen, you can speak to this because. When you're in the room that you designed with the 700 exploding barrels and you explode it, that is an incredibly immersive experience. And that is you swinging that hammer or swinging that wrench, right, to do it. That's not a contradiction.
Right.
But it's just another way to experience that is when you have these high impact moments with you controlling Sprocket doing a thing. I think the player is meant to feel a little bit closer to the experience in that way.
Yeah.
Right? There's not an always this way, always that way about it. I don't think it's uncommon for games, but that was deliberate on my part to make sure that there was you pass through a membrane when that happened, I think. Or I'd like to think that would happen.
Sure.
I don't know, Ellen, how would you think about that?
Yeah, I think the way that this, I kind of asked Perplexity to summarize it for me, but the way that it's talking about it in literature is definitely about like the reader's exposure to the thoughts of the protagonist character.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, we have an entire different axis of stuff to play with in games, because at least in video games and games of any sort, we have mechanics. So I thought that the notes that are essentially like in Sprocket's perspective about the objects, like the toothpaste, are kind of the way something that they describe And some of these sources are in the summary as indirect thought. So it offers a glimpse into the character's mind, but maintains a degree of separation by summarizing. When the gameplay lines up with what you know about the character, I think that puts you in kind of a direct thought, which is like the next layer in.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I really liked about that room is like, I got to just like let loose the soul of my inner Sprocket and just embrace the chaos.
Yeah.
Right. Because like Sprocket will cause, he causes mayhem mm-hmm. and mischief. And that room is all about massive amounts of mayhem and mischief.
Yeah. Right.
And you spend 10, 15 minutes setting it up so you can just unleash it in this one glorious moment. And yeah. I thought, you know, I feel like that is kind of creating an experience of, I guess if you want to look at it through that lens, an experience of closer psychic distance to our protagonist
yeah.
player character.
Right. And so at the same vein, because none of the crew members, when you jump between levels and things, reference any of that, the actual carnage that you're providing to the game, it like that distance pulls back. You as a player like pull back from the narrative of the game.
Yeah.
As a result of that, which is interesting.
I think it is more complicated in games because it's not just. There's not just more that contributes to it, it's dynamic, right?
Yes.
So in those cutscenes, we have dramatic irony, but we understand what those characters are thinking.
Right.
Because they're just, it's a log entry. They're telling us what they're thinking. And then there's no reason to lie, so we know what their thoughts are.
Yeah.
But because we know different,
yeah.
then like it doesn't, so it, I guess depending on how this term is described, like in a written on the page perspective, it's pretty close.
Yeah.
But in a gameplay experience, it's, you know, it has that extra layer going on.
I think it still tracks with the gameplay experience as well. Like, I totally agree with Ellen in that, like, you know, there's certain instances when, like, there's a possibility to cause a ton of mischief and you're like, heck yeah, I got to do this because it's fun. And then in that moment, you are getting into the mindset that Sprocket might feel, right?
Well, it's not even that. It's you are now the author.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's true.
Sprocket has kind of Sprocket's not a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Sprocket has kind of a blank expression like a pet.
Yeah.
And that was deliberate as well, so that you, the player, would impose, you'd anthropomorphize the character.
Yeah.
Just because it's carrying a satchel, wearing socks, and swinging a wrench doesn't make it people.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Sprocket thinks they're people, but like Sprocket's not people.
Right.
You, the player, get to put that on it like you would a pet.
Yeah.
And so that distance is... It's not even, we don't decide it. It's the player decides. If they're swinging that wrench and blowing up all that stuff, they get to decide if that's what Sprocket wants to do.
Oh, that's true.
Or if it's just them pressing the A button.
That's fair.
You know?
And
that's a unique thing about games.
Yeah.
But I think developers have to make that space for players to decide.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they are establishing, because you can be playing a game where you're doing an action, there's a narrative twist or something that like you, there's a thing you didn't know, but the character would have known. That's a distant thing. All that's very interesting.
Yeah.
But if you want that closeness, you can narrate the thoughts of the character, but then that's just a book again.
Right.
With a controller. In games, the player can be the author.
Yeah.
And if the player is truly the author, then that there's no distance at all.
That's actually really interesting that the player can determine how close they feel to the character and the player character anyways at any given moment. That's fascinating.
And the developer can prevent that.
Yeah.
And to a point, it can, you know, for a purpose.
Well, that's what cutscenes do, right? As an example.
Pretty frequently. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they might be close in the definition per a book that is, you see a cutscene of a character saying what their thoughts are and you're very close to it.
Right.
But at the same time, you are playing as that character. So it kind of feels sort of apart because you're not deciding.
Because you're not.
Things. Yeah, they're not your thoughts anymore.
Exactly.
You know.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea to play around with that as like an active choice.
Yeah.
Maybe something that has mechanics set to it.
Yeah.
Where you can at any point or at key moments choose, make some choice, take some action to facilitate closer psychic distance or more maintain a greater psychic distance as a player.
Yeah. So that's
play around with that.
That's interesting because I feel like that's a little bit how I have not played enough of this game to really know, but that's a little bit how Disco Elysium works. You mostly just play as the main character, but the main character has a whole bunch of different parts of his brain. And sometimes those parts of his brain will interject in between conversations and things like that, that like both pull you into this character, but also separate you from the character, because a lot of those thoughts make no sense. it's kind of interesting, because I feel like that game in particular plays around with that idea in a way that feels intentional, that they understand what psychic distance is, that I don't, in ways that I don't yet.
Well, it establishes the limit of this as a term that comes from a literary space when applied to games. But I think that's what I like about taking this kind of language, this kind of terminology, this kind of lens from other media into games, because then you start to really drill down into what they actually are.
Yeah.
Because you're no longer tethered to just the terminology.
Right.
If you look at it from a different perspective, you're like, oh, that's not fully compatible because it doesn't cover all these cases. Well, then that means it's not actually an actual definitive explanation for what this phenomenon is. And it's exciting, because then you get to think about it in a more robust way. So I really like that you brought it into the clubhouse.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad I did too. I will have to do some more thinking about what this can mean and what it does mean with respect to games, because it's really fascinating.
Yeah, come up with a working theory as to how we would, because one thing games is missing from the development space is a lot of the language for how we make it different from other media.
Yes.
We're still thinking of it in terms of other media, and it's really limiting what's possible.
So
the more we can take, you know, things and make our versions of it, the more we can do with this medium.
Absolutely.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and developer versus tester. It's different. Find out why. So go there and reply there and on the various platforms, or you can email us contact@nicegames.club. We are also on Patreon, as we have mentioned multiple times. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. You can sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.